Hey everybody, welcome to the new, I'm calling it new, Politically Incorrect Podcast 2.0. The reason I'm calling it new is we now have a co-host, and this co-host is not just a co-host, okay? This guy is served his time. That's right. He spent 10 years on the radio as a talk show host in the state of Florida and lives to talk about it. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Let me introduce you to our new Politically Incorrect co-host, Dan Maduri. Dan, pleasure to have you.
You know, Jim, I was thinking to myself, is it really sad that when you said I survived 10 years on terrestrial radio, that like literally lit me up, because that's the most accurate way to describe the entire situation in the entire last decade. It was just absolutely feeling like you have to survive just based on what the medium has become.
It is. I mean, it's weird because you and I have been around politics. We've been friends for many years now. And there are times we just look at each other like, you got to be kidding. I mean, really? And then you've got to go on the air and talk about it. And in some cases, try to rationalize something that is totally irrational.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah,
and do it. Not only do it, but do it for 3 hours.
Yeah, and not only do you have to do that and try to sit there and have conversations and rationalize things that are irrational, right. But then when you do get big name political guests on, you know, they don't say anything. It's like they're all just like the Marco Rubio robot that broke down famously during the 2016 primary. It's like everybody has resorted back to that. Doesn't matter what the question is. Doesn't matter how you frame it, how you ask it, they just resort back to just general talking points to the point where you're thinking to yourself, why am I even talking to you? Why am I doing this to myself?
Why did I ask a question and he's not even answering it? I was like, yeah. I remember during the 2016 campaign, I interviewed Bernie Sanders on this podcast 5 times. I asked Bernie the question 5 times about, you know, Medicare for all and all the different, you know, social programs that he has. And I just said, Bernie, look, it's fine. That's lovely. How do you pay for it? And, you know, he always would circle back to, well, if you did this, this, and this, it's like, yeah, that's lovely. But you do realize that Congress, the people, you know, you're a senator. That Senate's not changing much. Even if it changed over, you know, if it changed to Democrats, it would be hard to get the votes to get past what he wants to pass. And I'm not saying that he's not sincere about it. I'm not saying that there's not merit to it. I'm just simply saying, to your point, that trying to make politicians rational, even when you're talking to them about their programs, is almost impossible.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder about that too, Jim. I mean, you sit there and, you know, you hear that kind of default answer, and people who are sophisticated and understand like how government works. I mean, like you, when you're talking to Bernie Sanders, you know it's not going to work. He knows it's not going to work, and yet they say it anyway. So it almost feels like they are assuming that the national public is stupid and does not understand how these things work, and then they just figure out, oh, we'll just get in office and we'll figure out how to do a little bit of something, then we'll just blame the opposing party when we're in, to the point where nothing ever gets done. So it's almost like it really bothers me, because it does end up feeling like they're just assuming your ignorance going into those interviews.
Yeah, and then, for instance, we can talk about the fact that people are saying, well, Washington is broken. Well, you know, it's not, okay? It's the people you send to Washington, ladies and gentlemen, that are broken. We have, as you and I sit here today, the United States Congress has sent 200 bipartisan bills to the Senate, where Mitch McConnell is sitting there, and not one of them has hit the floor of the United States Senate for even a conversation. We we cannot allow this stuff to continue. And I'm not talking about just Republicans and Democrats. I mean, because, you know, there you could find things, you know, when Harry Reid was in charge that that was an issue. Mm-hmm. But the fact mm-hmm. that Congress has sent 200 pieces of legislation to the Senate and they haven't acted on one is just, you know, if that doesn't tell you that the system is broken, I'm not sure what does.
Yeah, didn't that go back to this, the people get the government that they deserve? And I do think it's fascinating. Like every year you see them come out with some sort of crazy statistic that, you know, says that Congress has like an 8 or 10 or 12. I think since the last 10 years that I've been working in news, Congress one time mm-hmm. got over 15% approval rating in the last 10 years. And so, but what's interesting is that they always come out with these stories and statistics that basically state that not only does Congress have a 15% approval rating? We'll just, you know, just throw that out there as a high because I remember that being right. a high number. But yet the individual congressman is usually seen very favorably in their individual district. So I think it's funny. It's like so people don't look at their individual congressman as the issue, as the problem.
Right.
They look at Congress as a whole, as if it's its own entity, an organism as a whole that is broken and shot and everything they hate. But they don't look at the specificity of the individual congressman in their role in the grand scheme of things, which I always find fascinating.
It's amazing. You know, it's totally amazing. And you can allow small groups, whether it be on the right, like the Freedom Caucus, or on the left, like some of the more progressive people like AOC and that gang, to hijack your caucus. And suddenly nothing gets done, even in your own caucus. Because when Paul Ryan was in charge, and actually it started with John Boehner, and I love John Boehner for this reason. He's now playing golf down in Fort Myers. John, if you're listening, I hope you're enjoying yourself. John realized that he was under the use of what was called the Hastert Law. Now, for those of you who are not political science geeks, the Hastert Law was when the Speaker of the House was Dennis Hastert, and he came up with this concept that he would never put on the floor of the United States House of Representatives a bill that didn't have the majority of the majority in charge of that body supporting it. So in other words, if you tried like Tip O'Neill, when President Reagan was having an issue and he was having an issue with his own party, Tip O'Neill thought that a couple of bills that Reagan wanted passed that were being sponsored by Republicans were good laws, but that the caucus was, you know, going nuts. So he basically sat down and said, look, we're going to pass these for the president of the United States because A, they're good laws, and B, because that's the thing to do. So that when Dennis Hastert took over, Hastert decided, well, you know, whatever sides in majority, if I don't see that they're all supporting it, then it can't possibly be the right law, which is a bit of a wrong thinking way of doing it, but okay, fine. So anyway, the Hastert rule is something that Congress has lived by for a while now. And Pelosi, to her credit, pushed it aside and said, fine, if, you know, whatever the bill is, if we got 218 votes on it, we're going to push it. And so that's why there's been a lot of bipartisan movement through, and why, for instance, a couple of guys in Florida, who Dan and I know, Gus Bilirakis and Charlie Crist and some of those guys, have actually done some bipartisan work and have, you know, a number of bills. They've been either on a number of bills or even sponsored a number of bills that have gone through the House, but, you know, are languishing there in the Senate just waiting for an opportunity, and they've never seen the light of day. So if you like your government, as Dan said, next time you go to a town hall meeting, say, hey, look, what the heck is going on? We know that you're doing your work. Why isn't it getting done in the Senate?
Yeah, so, I totally agree with that. I mean, it'd be interesting to go to those town halls, because I don't know if you've gone to like the local house district, whatever seat,
yeah,
congressional district, whatever seat. Yeah. But when you go to those town halls, it's usually like six people, and they're all very angry. You know, and they're all very angry about, you know, the simplistic, about the superficial, about, about trans members in the military, or about teachers carrying guns in schools. And it's like they're drawn to that direction, and they're never really drawn to the granular, simplistic, or granular, in-depth, nuanced government conversation of like, well, because these bills have just been sitting there in the Senate and have not gone forward and have not been pushed forward by Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, that they just they just sit there, and so nobody even probably realizes that it's happening. They probably don't even realize it's happening. They're probably just sitting there emotional, and every time a tweet goes out, that's when they're going to turn around and really try to, you know, decide where they are on whatever issue it is, even though those are the ones that get the most coverage, and the good ones, well, they're the ones that are always hammered down and no one even knows it's happening.
You know what's even more funny, and I say that funny not in a ha-ha way, but sarcastic way perhaps. Anyway, on the evening back in 2017, when the day that will last in infamy for President Donald Trump, when John McCain voted, put the thumb down and said, no, we will not vote for the skinny repeal, which, again, ladies and gentlemen, if you honestly believe that John McCain is the man who sunk, you know, the repeal of Obamacare, it's crazy, because he didn't. What that law was called a skinny repeal. It was not, all it was technically saying that we wouldn't even use the name Obamacare. That's all. It would not have ruined anything. I mean, literally, it wouldn't have done a thing. And at the beginning of the week, it was kind of like a tell, right? At the beginning of the week, McCain gives this impassioned speech that he comes back from, you know, has the brain tumor. He came back to Washington because he wanted to have something that 60 people could vote for. He said he wanted regular order on it, okay? For those of you, again, who don't know what regular order, that's back in the day, they would have 60 votes for it so that just 51 votes would not mean that that's how it would be done. So anyway, that down goes the, you know, John McCain gives the thumbs down. One of the people, Dan, who I've always been quite, think that he's a very thoughtful person, is Lamar Alexander. And Lamar Alexander is a Republican senator from the state of Tennessee, for those of you who are not following along in your guidebooks. On that eve, actually, back going back to 2013, Dan, right after the Obamacare thing passed in 2010, in 2013, most of the good parts, as we like to say, it came into being. And I sat one day with Senator Alexander, and I asked him, will this ever, you know, there was the, at that point, the repeal, you know, situation was rolling. And I said, do you ever think it will get repealed? And he said, no. And I said, why? And he said, because once you give people something that they like, it's hard as hell to take it away from them. And so on that day, Dan, early in the morning, Senator Lamar Alexander walked across the aisle to Patty Murray, the senator from Alaska, and they had a joint bill, a bipartisan bill, that would repair pieces and parts of the Affordable Care Act and begin the process of working on a new healthcare system within the United States. And that has 60 votes, but it's not ever going to see the light of day. McConnell has yet to let it go on the floor. And that's with someone as respected as Lamar Alexander is. He's been in the Senate longer than McConnell has been in the Senate. But, you know, God forbid you try to do something bipartisan, it ain't going to happen. Not on his watch.
Yeah. Well, especially not now in the primary season where you know you've got 23 candidates that have declared from the Democratic in the Democratic primary, and clearly they're all chomping at the bit, they're all foaming at the mouth, except for one Joe Biden. So that then does in fact end up influencing decisions on Capitol Hill for right or wrong.
Right. True. Very good. Very good point. Let's talk. You were talking about the two football, basically you have a football team. You got 11 offense, 11 defense running that are all running now for president on the Democratic ticket. Your thoughts on, give me your top, give me your Fab Five. Who's going to survive and be the five or six candidates left standing after the early debates come in just a couple weeks, or actually in less than 2 weeks.
I would say this, like right off the bat, number one, I would say, why is the DNC capping it at 20 candidates? I mean, I know they've got formats they want to fit in. I know they want to give talking time to bona fide candidates, but if you're the Democratic Party and your bench has been so decimated over the last 10 to 12 years, it would stand to reason that you would want as many bodies up there as humanly possible in the hopes that somebody would catch fire a la 2008 Barack Obama and become a shooting star for your entire party. So the fact that they're capping it at 20 candidates doesn't really make any sense to me, because they need all the publicity they can get, and they need all the numbers that they can get, and more numbers for them means more people get, bona fide time in front of the American public and get to start building their brands and making people understand that they're, they're okay, they're not the boogeyman, they're not this, they're not that. That said, I would say that when I start looking at the list of the names that are out there and the people that are out there, it's just too many people. It's just too many people. There's not enough talent in all these campaigns to run these campaigns. Some of them look sloppy, look ridiculous, and they've looked sloppy and looked ridiculous. I mean, I don't understand why half of the people are actually in it. I think that the individuals who are going to bubble up at the top, I mean, it's going to be the same old names. It's going to be Joe Biden. It's going to be Elizabeth Warren. It's going to be Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris to a certain degree, Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor. It looks like he's got some lasting power. Everyone else is done. I mean, it's already over for all those people. I mean, Beto O'Rourke, the rock star of Texas, who right away conceded his race within, the first 5 minutes when the polls closed? I mean, here's this bona fide rock star, and he's forever changed Texas, and he's going to unseat Ted Cruz. I knew that race was a fraudulent race when I saw a picture of Ted Cruz on an airplane mid-campaign season, and he was looking at a picture of Beto, and the picture of Beto that he was looking at on this airplane, Beto was tan, his hair was cut, he had a tailored suit, he was in shape, he was standing on top of whatever he's standing, apparently likes to climb things, he was standing on top of whatever it is that he was standing on top of, and there's Ted Cruz, with the quintessential dad bod, he's pale, he didn't even shave, his hair is disheveled, and it's like, if you actually thought you were going against someone who was going to be a contender, these are the basic things that you do when you run for office. You go to the tanning bed, you cut your hair, you shave yourself, you do a couple of sit-ups, you do a couple of push-ups, and then you go out there and reintroduce yourself to the public if you're Ted Cruz. He didn't even bother with any of that. So that campaign was dead on arrival. It was a social media sensation. People built it up to something that I don't think it ever actually was. Beto O'Rourke is not a Kennedy-esque type person. I think he has made just flabbergasting errors over and over again. I mean, who announces they're running for president, especially when you've built the brand of, I am the everyday individual, I am you encapsulated, I get you, and makes their announcement? Was it Vogue or was it Vanity Fair? Who does that? And say, I don't know, maybe like the second coming?
Maybe he went to Vanity Fair because Field and Stream had somebody. I don't know.
was DuJure not available?
Right, exactly. Must have been. I mean, it's like he was looking for TV Guide. Is somebody out there going to – Vanity Fair said, why not? Beto looks good. And by the way, thank God it wasn't GQ. It would have been a $1,000, suit and the whole routine. So it would be like, yes, here he is. He just walked out in his Ralph Lauren outfit, ladies and gentlemen, Beto O'Rourke. Not exactly. Yeah. A little tone deaf when you're talking about, you know, politicians feathering their nest and, oh no, never me. I'm in Vanity Fair. That'll be $5.95 for that copy of Vanity Fair, where you can read all about how I'm going to help the common man.
You got to answer me this question. Have you ever seen more fake humility than what comes out of the Beto O'Rourke camp? I mean, not only does he fraudulently apologize for basically everything, from being born to being white to being this to being that. But don't you just feel like the humility there is totally fake, and that's how you end up on the cover of Vanity Fair?
I'm not certain what, you know, Beto was thinking. I mean, clearly, he had some traction going, and I think that. Yeah. But I think that, look, here's the thing to me. He was a congressman. All right, fine. But his problem running for president is he lost. He lost a race for Senate. Okay.
Yeah.
You're not going to beat Donald Trump. So why don't you try another time to beat Ted Cruz? You know, a lot of these guys.
If he ran again to try to beat Ted Cruz, he would lose if he ran again against Ted Cruz. And then all of a sudden you're a two-time loser. And that's
But there's you don't have to run against Ted Cruz. You could run against, you know, the other senators, John Cornyn.
You could run for ag commish, which is a very important position, to go against the Bush, George P. Bush, which would be very interesting to watch happen and unfold. Sure. But it's like, and this goes back to, you know, on the campaign, if you watch any documentaries on Beto's campaign, basically every reporter and their mother and then people in the crowd were telling Beto O'Rourke, you're a rock star, you're a rock star, you're a rock star, you're a rock star. And I think that's how you end up on Vanity Fair. You end up believing, well, I'm a rock star. I should be on, you know, some sort of, you know, incredible, amazing publication that solidifies my status. And that's how you end up on Vanity Fair. But, you know, to kind of move off Beto O'Rourke, because I think his campaign was DOA and continues to show that it has no legs and is going nowhere. I think Joe Biden is, you know, the most stable person in the race, and most notably so, Joe Biden's the one who's, you know, really lying low, minimal interactions with the media, you know, basically being on his best behavior, keeping his hands to himself, you know, having, you know, not swinging for the fences, just looking to hit singles, and he's letting everybody else cannibalize themselves. And so when you're Joe Biden, you're watching it all unfold. I mean, I think this is where it becomes a little bit. One, it's a little bit savvy, and two, it's also the built-in benefit of being not just a 30-plus year senator, but also a two-term VP person, that he doesn't have to scrap, fight, and try to climb his way out of the cave. You know, he can sit there and allow this to unfold and just deal with whatever challenger ends up kind of bubbling up at the top. So he is the built-in benefit of being a household name and people just kind of understanding that he is who he is. Although I would say it does seem like his age is going to be a problem. I mean, everywhere you look, people are just, you know, they're just, are we really going to trade one old white guy for another old white guy? So I do think his age is going to end up being a problem, don't you?
Well, I think sure. I mean, look, let's be honest, okay? We've got, if you take, you know, let's set Elizabeth Warren aside for just a moment. You're looking at Donald Trump, who runs...
Who's older than Hillary Clinton, by the way.
Yes, exactly. He will be 74 when he runs for president. Joe will be 76. Bernie will be 80. Okay? That's not exactly, you know, moving forward. And again, I'm not throwing shade on any of these three guys. I'm simply saying that if you're looking for generational change, normally you don't see generational change in an 80-year-old, in a 76-year-old, and in a 74-year-old. And so that, I think, to your point, is going to be, sure. I mean, you've got to factor in age. I mean, you literally got to factor in age. Going all the way back to Reagan, you were talking about that.
Yeah. And let me ask you this question too,
sure.
because you know, Americans, our culture, it's in our DNA. You know, we want to be first, and we hate to admit that we're wrong. We want to be first, and we hate to admit that. That goes back to the whole idea of the power and the incumbency. When Americans, whether it's a district office, a city office, a statewide office, or a federal office, or the presidency, you know, when we put somebody into place, it's very difficult to unseat them and beat them until they have turned themselves out, unless they've done something disastrous in their first term, because we hate to admit that we are wrong. So I do think that there's a certain amount of that, where people do go into the polls, they do go into the ballot box, and they think to themselves, okay, you know, I'm voting for Joe right now, he's 76, am I really going to vote for an 80-year-old, though? Am I going to put him in this till he's 84 years old? And Bernie Sanders is even worse. Like, are you really going to have an 88-year-old in office? I mean, it's like, who's always already kind of kooky. It's like, no, I mean, that's just like, especially when you think about the idea of, you know, riding the ship and having somebody presidential in office. I just don't think that lends itself to a, you know, a radical democratic, a socialist who looks a little weird and who Larry David has torched on SNL, all in good fun. But has torched him to the point where he's made him like this kooky uncle that everybody just kind of laughs at, but just dismisses. Are we really going to put someone like that in office? I don't think so.
Well, Bernie's problem, in my own personal experience, is that he's been around. What you see on Bernie here is, I can tell you, I had this conversation with someone. I mean, I've heard this Bernie. I've been uncovering Washington for almost 22 years. I've heard Bernie's shtick 15 years ago. It's not changed. This is the same stuff. It's you know, he's just got a better audience for it now, or an audience at least is listening. He, you know, he's been saying, beating the same drum for 20 years. So on the consistency level, Bernie's not changed. This is 100% Bernie. Okay. What he says is what he believes. That's 100%. There's nothing that Bernie is saying that he does not believe. Okay. So I give him props for authenticity. Okay. Bernie has never, there's no flip flopping on Bernie in that regard. He is 100% staying true to the brand, whatever the hell that brand is. I think that Elizabeth Warren is beginning to seep away at Bernie in the polls, in large part because there may not be a person out there running for office who has more detailed position papers on every possible thing you can imagine, whether you like it or not, okay, than Elizabeth Warren. And she also can explain them. You know, she's a former professor. She's very good at taking that and explaining it well. So I think that Bernie's problem is that there are a couple of little Bernie-ettes out there that are going to seep away from Bernie, because Bernie's positions are positions on basically two or three issues. Okay, beyond those two or three issues, Bernie's clueless. But Elizabeth Warren is a detailed person. And that, I think, will be interesting. You talked about Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is someone who I think when they begin the debate cycle, I think she's going to rise. She's got a very strong presence. And she's very, if you saw her in the hearings, there are a number of different hearings where she was just, you know, she showed that she used to be a prosecutor. You can tell she was very quick and precise and gave good, quick, precise answers and was not in any way long-winded. So, you know, we'll see. And I think that these debates coming up soon, they're going to definitely open some people's eyes, and we'll see, because, you know, Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, it's a small town.
Pete Buttigieg. I think it's too big of a jump.
It'll be interesting.
I don't think the American public puts in a mayor of a town of 100,000 people, you know, even if it is the Midwest, even if it has experienced some sort of either resurgence or renaissance under his leadership. I just don't think they do that. And then you also couple that with the fact that he's in his late 30s. I'm just not there.
Well, he might be at the too young age.
Yeah, he might. Yeah, it falls right in line with my ageist theory. You know, to say that, well, people just seasoned enough that they've got a track record and got a resume, and it's not a massive jump, right? And he's lacking something that, you know, I think that a lot of people would like to see, and that would aid him in that big massive jump when he's skipping. Basically, he's going from A to D rather than doing B, C. I do think that, you know, he is boring. I think he's horrifically boring. And I think that all the, you know, sexy photo shoots and all the, you know, him putting on his tie and getting dressed, and all those things, it just doesn't add anything when you actually hear him speak. When you see, he doesn't have any charisma. The stage command just really not there. Not saying the stage is too big for him, because I don't think it is. I don't see him being somebody who oozes charisma that puts a tingle up of Chris Matthews' leg. It just doesn't happen. It's not happening. So I think that, you know, he kind of misses that. But, you know, Jim, it seems like you're kind of falling in line with me, where, you know, there really are no dark horses. Yes, there are 23 people in the race, but there really are no dark horses that you look up and say, that person, be careful, they could jump out and snake bite you.
Well, I see Pete Buttigieg as having this title ahead of his name, Vice President Pete Buttigieg. I see a lot of people who, you know, candidate wise, who, if you're a president, looks at Buttigieg and go, you know, he would be someone I would have as a vice president because he's got bona fides as a war hero. He's gay. He is thoughtful. He can speak six languages. He's a smart guy. Rhodes Scholar. He's got all the resume that you would want, but he's 37 years old.
And, you know, old nine yards, yeah.
Yeah. So, and look, let's be straight up.
But that goes back to who would be the VP. I mean, or who would be the president, right? If it's Kamala Harris, she might pick Pete Buttigieg, which, by the way, how awesome would that be to watch Buttigieg and Pence battle for the soul of Indiana? If it does, in fact, come down to
the
VP and the proper VP.
Oh, I would pay money for that. Because as everybody in this podcast knows, my love for the vice president is such that he's blocked me from Twitter. But
I was gonna say, you leaned on him pretty hard. I've never seen you lean on someone like that.
I would love to see this. This is an optic, right? Buttigieg and Pence debating, and Buttigieg wearing a pride tie. It's just, I mean, I'm not sure that Pence would be able to be in the room with him. I swear to God.
Do you think Pence would pin the crucifix to his jacket or something like that?
I don't know. It would be most uncomfortable day in his life. Or instead, if he walked over instead of shaking hands, he gave him a big hug and a kiss.
Went in for the full thing. Went in for the real
thing. Okay, and ladies and gentlemen, this is Jim Williams talking. It's not Stan Venturi. Anything you want to email to me or hit me up on Twitter and go after me for this, fine. Leave Dan alone. He has nothing to do with it.
I do think it's going to end, and it's going to be – there's a ton of people in it. I think it's going to end up being – The most obvious ticket, I think, ends up being the ticket. I think it's Biden Harris, and I think I think that's going to be the Democratic ticket.
I wouldn't argue. I think that, look, at the end of the day, the Democrats, it's all about electability. You know, they want who could win, and whether or not Joe. You know, there was I know there's a lot of conversation prior to Joe running, making the announcement, as to whether or not he would make the announcement straight up that he was only going to run for 4 years, and that he was going to pick a vice president who he felt in 4 years' time would be logically the person who would succeed him, to try to blunt some of the ageism questions. And that was kind of pushed under the rug for a while anyway. And so I don't know if the back of his mind, that's something he's thinking. But, look, you can say a lot about Joe Biden. He's made missteps, no question about it. down through the years. But in all candor, I have ridden the train with him. I had to go to Philadelphia a couple times, up to New York a couple times, and been on the train. And he genuinely will sit down and talk to everybody and anybody. And this was when he was a senator and when he was vice president. And it's hard not to like this guy. And if you're actually physically in the same room with them, it's even more difficult, because he will genuinely sit and listen to you. And you can tell he's listening to you because he calls you by your first name. And he also, if he sees you 10 days later, a week later, a year later, he remembers your name. He walks over to you. He shakes your hand. More often than not, it feels like he's going to take it off when he shakes it. Slap you on the back. He is a blue-collar guy. And, does he have warts? Yes. This is this is not the perfect guy. But he is, as you said, I think he is the most logical person. And I think the Kamala Harris would be a very good number two on that ticket. It would be formidable for Trump Pence to beat Biden and Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Also, I want to say something about Joe Biden, in the sense that, has he made missteps? Yes. But I mean, it's almost like, he was elected in 1973 as a U.S. Senator, for heaven's sake, right, from Delaware, obviously. And it's like, if he hasn't made any missteps since 1973, then he doesn't even, nothing has happened. So, he basically lived long enough in public office where things that were popular at the time are no longer popular. And, right, to quote the Dark Knight, he lived long enough to see himself become the villain on some of those things instead of dying the hero. And, frankly, I think that is a sign of leadership. I mean, if he'd been in office since 73 and nobody had ever heard of him and he had never done anything in life, then you'd be saying, well, he's not a leader. But since he's done things in life, since he's headed up some of the most important committees, since he's made important decisions and been behind important decisions, people are saying, well, did you remember he did this and did that and did this? It's like, yes, because he went there to do things and to accomplish things. And sometimes those things end up haunting you 30, 40 years down the road.
Right. But, to your point, if you look at Senate records, right, Joe Biden's record in the Senate, no person in his period of time in the Senate has sponsored more bipartisan legislation than Joe Biden. And, I know bipartisanship in some regards is a bad word, but Biden accomplished a great deal as a senator. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You're going to, the crime bill, the Anita Hill situation, every one of those are things that Joe Biden will be tested on over the next coming months. And there's no way that you can't say, all right, well, I was there, I did it. Yeah. Do I wish I hadn't? Now, yes. But at the time, it made sense. So, it'll be interesting to see, but I don't, when some of these guys take pot shots at him, I think that there's going to be an audience out there, the Joe Biden audience, is going to sit there and go, yeah, well, okay, look, they're trying to take a shot at Joe. What have they done? And there aren't a lot of people on that stage that have done much yet. Certainly nothing to the extent of what Biden's done. So, you want to punch up at him? Fine, punch up. I don't know that you're going to hit him, but we'll see. I mean, stranger things have happened. Speaking of stranger things, make America straight again. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Just when you thought it had gotten too crazy out there, this weekend, if you happen to be in the Orlando area and you hate gay people, we've got someplace for you to go. It's Make America Straight Again. It is a group of preachers who are getting together and they're going to celebrate the 1 year anniversary of the 49 people who were killed at the Pulse nightclub by celebrating it in a very odd way. And in some regards, you know, this is, it's almost like it's surreal, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised. I don't know. It's uncomfortable, to say the least. Your thoughts, Mr. Maduri?
Yeah, no, it's always uncomfortable, to say the least. And I always look at these individuals, I just think to myself, that they're, you know, they're not really pastors, preachers, whatever, the ministers, whatever they want to call themselves. They're not. And this goes back to, just like everything else, just like before you go to a doctor who's going to heal you physically, you better do some research on them and make sure that they actually have the degrees and actually know what the heck they, what they are and what they do before you go under the knife with them. And I feel like the same thing now is happening in the country when it comes to going to religious houses of religion. You almost have to do your due diligence and research the pastor or priest or whoever might be up there sharing a gospel or a message with you to make sure that your soul is not going to be inundated with evil aspects and manipulative types of conversations. I mean, but it's not the first time. And if you remember correctly, a pastor by the name of Donnie Ramiro, who founded Steadfast Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas, he came out and said that he was happy that that 49 people at the gay nightclub in Orlando, Pulse nightclub, were killed. And then, of course, a couple of months ago, he was arrested for allegedly using drugs, gambling, and paying for sex with prostitutes. So, I mean, these people are, you know, they're miscreants. You know, they're just the worst kind. They are preying on people in a predatory sense and using religion to do it. And I just honestly believe that there is truly a special place in hell for somebody who does such a thing.
Yes. And by the way, just pick up Dante's Inferno and pick a ring, whichever one you want, folks, just pick a ring in hell and put your favorite person there. I gotta say, look, this is not the first time that religion has been weaponized. Let's be honest. Those of us who've studied history know that going way back, we're talking thousands of years, religion has been used to weaponize people. And here's the thing, Dan, and, you know, this is why I think sometimes I'm not sure that most of these people passed an 11th grade civics test. The actual Constitution of the United States, and the reason we left England was not because we didn't like the food, okay? And God knows that's a good enough reason to leave anyway, but let's just say we didn't leave because of the food. It was because we wanted a religious freedom, number one, and we didn't want a government that was ruled by the church. So we set up a government that in the Constitution is supposed to separate the church and state. Yet, for reasons that I'm not terribly sure of, there is this weaponization of religion that says I, no matter who I particularly am, I need to be the moral leader of you, which means someone is taking and usurping my moral compass, whatever it may be, or your moral compass, and whatever it may be, and saying, hey, look, I'm going to be the, it's got to be this way because that's the way it's got to be. And it's like, no, no, no. We are not electing the Pope in chief. We are electing a president in chief. So no matter whether you're a Jew or Catholic or Baptist or, you know, Seventh-day Adventist or Muslim or whomever, okay? Have your morals, but don't, for God's sake, weaponize religion and make it part of government, which is what we're seeing going on with these abortion situations in these states and in other things, where we're actually literally using the government to become morally more to a right or left position, whatever it may be. I just, it scares me when people don't realize from government, the first thing about government is that it has to be something that is not, it's got to separate religion and politics. Just the way it
yeah.
is.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think it also goes back to that, you know, the old religious teachings of love thy neighbor as thyself. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, that got lost. I mean, it's a good one. It's more of the conversation of, I thought religion was about empathy, was about compassion, was about love mm-hmm. and understanding. And instead, it's just like everything else in life, whether it's, you know, kneeling during the national anthem in the NFL or, mm-hmm. you know, wearing a hoodie and hands up, don't shoot. Everything mm-hmm. has to be weaponized now, and everything has to be a position which is divisive, and everything has to be something that is wedged between everybody else. And that's what we're seeing again with religion, which I guess, if you know, historically speaking, I guess you could say religion has been used that way for a long period of time. But this, you know, this isn't even, to me, these aren't even priests or pastors. I mean, they're provocateurs. Right. I mean, that's what they are. Yeah. I mean, they would, the next thing you know, they're going to be giving their sermon and they're going to like slaughter a pig and bathe in its blood on the stage and say it was for, you know, a sacrificial aspect, and oh, by the way, it'll also protect me from Islam or something like that. Right. I mean, it's going to be so
speaking in tongues.
That's the next step.
Yeah,
and that's the next step. Or and then the next step after that is, of course, you know, they take their flock down to South America and they all Jim Jones each other. I mean, that's the finality of this. That's the finality, and that's the destination of the road these people are on.
Yeah, absolutely. And to put a button on it, I'll buy the Kool-Aid if they want to go. Anyway, so, okay, we've talked about, you know, the upcoming presidential hopefuls, many of whom we will be talking to right here on the Politically Incorrect podcast. So even though we gave our little heads up on who's going to be there, we'll listen to the others. We'll give them a chance to explain to us why they should be the Democratic nominee. And we'll give them that opportunity. We had a little fun at the expense of the folks doing their best to make fools of themselves in Orlando on the Pulse nightclub thing. But in all seriousness, that is a sick situation. But I don't think we'll have to worry about wasting any more time on that one. Daniel, before we get out of here, this week, John Stewart came to town, gave a very impassioned speech, which he has been at least consistent over the last decade in trying to get benefits for the 9/11 first responders. Gave an impassioned speech. There wasn't many congressmen there to see it or senators there to see it. It ended up the next day, went through unanimously, fortunately. And I think everybody's happy that the 9/11 responders are going to get what they deserve in the way of healthcare and other issues that need to be addressed that they got through the Congress. But you had an interesting thought about the messenger, John Stewart, and I yield the remainder of my time to you to open up on that.
Well, no, I mean, I was just kind of wondering to myself out loud when it comes to John Stewart. I mean, obviously a moral cause, a noble cause, the right cause. He's in the right. History will be kind to him, you know, and all of that jazz. But I do wonder to myself, because, you know, everyone I talk to in D.C., whether, you know, they're just lowly interns or chief of staff for, you know, United States senators or House congressmen, is that they're all very petty, and they're all looking to squeeze the opposition, exact their pound of flesh anytime they possibly can, and they're looking to inflict pain on them because they view them as the enemy and view them as the opposition. Now, John Stewart, you know, was the best in the business at what he did, which was making a mockery of our government system, pointing out hypocrisy, and then lining it with, you know, a straight talk of, you know, the moral substance of what you should be doing and why are you not doing this. And why he did take shots at both political parties throughout his tenure on The Daily Show from 1999, when he first started The Daily Show, mm-hmm. most of his aim was directed towards the GOP was directed towards Republicans. And then you got to think about it on a grander scale of not only was it him doing it personally, but then he was a great cultivator of talent and people who went off to do their own things. And so he basically built a brilliant show, built out a brilliant show, had it humming and making great money for Comedy Central, but then was also spawning off little mini me's of him who were also very talented people in their own right. Whether it's Steve Carell,
Stephen Colbert.
Whether it was whether it's Samantha Bee, whether it was John Oliver. I mean, all of these people started on The Daily Show, and every single week they're giving the GOP and raking the GOP over the coals and getting millions and millions of people watching it, retweeting it, thinking about it. So I wonder to myself if they do not look at Jon Stewart as kind of the genesis of their battle that was lost, which is television and online, and was it Jon Stewart's fault for creating all of this plethora of talent and very capable individuals who then in turn use their talent to manipulate, to inform, and to disinform the American public? So I do wonder if the GOP themselves are screwing around with this particularly because they know it gets under Jon Stewart's skin. They know it's personal to him being a New Yorker, and they want to kind of twist that knife in his ribcage over and over again as much as humanly possible because how they view him in his legacy.
It's interesting. I will say that. And I think that what's going to be fun is that, the Daily Show that Jon started, and of course Colbert and John Oliver on This Week on HBO, they're all there, but it is a bit of crazy that's gone on with that this past week. And it's before we leave, folks, so we're just going to let you know that we will play that 9 minutes of Jon Stewart so you can hear it, because I know a lot of people have said they wanted to hear what had happened or they missed it. And so if you did miss it, not to worry. It'll be the final 9 minutes of the show. So if you heard it, then when we say goodbye, then you don't have to listen anymore because we're going to tack that on. If you haven't heard it, then stick with it and hang out for the 9 minutes. It's a very impassioned speech. It's something you don't really need to – there's no visuals that you need to see. You're not going to miss any visuals on it. And if you do, then go to YouTube. You can find it there with 100,000 other things. But any final thoughts, Dan, before we close up shop here on our first opportunity to work together, which I think's been kind of fun personally?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I hope that it's not a one and done situation.
Oh no, it's not. You're not getting rid of me that easily. Or you're not getting out of that this easily. Unlike terrestrial radio, we are here to stay, my friend. Doesn't work that easy. By the way, we're hoping to look forward to seeing you on MSNBC in the not too distant future. Hopefully that's going to work out where you get a chance to do a little bit of commentating down in Miami before the debates.
So yeah, I'm going to be down in Miami the 26th of June. I'll be with Craig Melvin, who is doing phenomenally well on MSNBC and just is now, I think, full-time on the Today Show.
Yes,
which
he is.
Which is an incredible feat for him and just a real great person personally and also great talent. And then I'll be following it up on the 27th with Haley Jackson. So 10 a.m. with Craig Melvin, and then I believe 11 o'clock hour with Haley Jackson.
And Haley, of course, is a friend of the podcast, one of our buds. So we're happy to say that she's going to be down there, and she's a great person and someone who, as I said, we enjoy her work on MSNBC. Well, before we get out of here, look, if you're not one of the already 25,000 people who listen to this podcast and subscribe to it on a weekly basis, first of all, shame on you. Second of all, we're easy to find. We're free. We're on the iTunes store. You can find us on the Apple Podcast. If you happen to be an Android user, you can find us on the Google Play Store, where we're on Google Podcasts. You can find us on Spreaker, Stitcher, Spotify, as well as TuneIn and iTunes. And I said iTunes once already, didn't I? Okay, well, you can find us on iTunes, but it's TuneIn. It's iHeartRadio, that's what I was trying to think of. iHeartRadio, YouTube, to name a few. If you can't find us, pull out the Google machine and type in the Politically Incorrect Podcast and hit the favorite button or the subscribe button. And every week you get a brand new edition of the podcast sent directly to your phone or to your tablet or to both. And if you happen to have an assistant device like Alexa or Google or any of the Apple products that answer to the name Siri, just say, hey, Siri or Google or Alexa, please play the latest edition of the Politically Incorrect Podcast and they'll do it for you. Okay. So we can't make it any easier. Please go out and subscribe today. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Why don't you give us your social media handles so that people can find you and follow you on social media?
Just all across the board at Dan Maduri.
Okay. There you go. Cool enough. All right, folks. Next week, hopefully, we'll have a guest to join us. And until that time, we're going to leave you, as I said before, with the powerful 9 minutes of Jon Stewart talking passionately about the need for taking care of the 9/11 responders. And until next week, for Dan Maduri, I'm Jim Williams saying have a wonderful week, and thanks for listening to this edition of the Politically Incorrect Podcast.
Life is about making decisions. At BMW i, we decided it was time to reinvent the car from the ground up. Making sure we were open for truly innovative ideas. We decided that the car we wanted must be electric. And it should be made of extremely light and super strong carbon fiber. And finally, we decided to make it more intelligent and added our promise of incomparable driving pleasure. We made all these decisions to offer you a choice. The all-electric BMW i3.
I want to thank Mr. Collins and Mr. Naylor for putting this together, but as I sit here today, I can't help but think what an incredible metaphor this room is for the entire process that getting health care and benefits for 9/11 first responders has come to. Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress. Sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak to no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. And you should be ashamed of yourselves for those that aren't here, but you won't be. Because accountability doesn't appear to be something that occurs in this chamber. We don't want to be here. Lou doesn't want to be here. None of these people want to be here. But they are, and they're not here for themselves. They're here to continue fighting for what's right. Lou's going to go back for his 69th chemo. The great Ray Pfeiffer would come down here, his body riddled with cancer and pain, where he couldn't walk. And the disrespect shown to him and to the other lobbyists on this bill is utterly unacceptable. You know, I would be so angry at the latest injustice that's done to these men and women. And, you know, another business card thrown our way as a way of shooing us away. Like children, trick-or-treating, rather than the heroes that they are and will always be. Ray would say, calm down, Johnny, calm down. I got all the cards I need. And he would tap his pocket. Where he kept the prayer cards, 343 firefighters, The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Thousands more poured in to continue to fight for their brothers and sisters. The breathing problem started almost immediately, and they were told they weren't sick, they were crazy. And then, as the illnesses got worse and things became more apparent, well, okay, you're sick, but it's not from the pile. And then when the science became irrefutable, okay, it's the pile. But this is a New York issue. I don't know if we have the money. And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry, and you should be too, and they're all angry as well, and they have every justification to be that way. There is not a person here, there is not an empty chair on that stage that didn't tweet out, never forget the heroes of 9/11. Never forget their bravery. Never forget what they did, what they gave to this country. Well, here they are. And where are they? And it would be one thing if their callous indifference and rank hypocrisy were benign, but it's not. Your indifference cost these men and women their most valuable commodity, time. It's the one thing they're running out of. This should be flipped. This hearing should be flipped. These men and women should be up on that stage, and Congress should be down here answering their questions as to why this is so damn hard and takes so damn long. And why, no matter what they get, something's always pulled back and they got to come back. Mr. Johnson, you made a point earlier, and it was one that we have heard over and over again in these halls, and I couldn't help but to answer to it, which was, you said, look, you know, you guys are obviously heroes, and 9/11 was a big deal, but, you know, we have a lot of stuff here to do, and you know, we got to make sure there's money for a variety of disasters, hurricanes and tornadoes. But this wasn't a hurricane, and this wasn't a tornado. And by the way, that's your job anyway. We can't fund these programs. You can. Setting aside that no American in this country should face financial ruin because of a health issue. Certainly 9/11 first responders shouldn't have to decide whether to live or to have a place to live. And the idea that you can only give them 5 more years of the VCF because you're not quite sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. Well, I can tell you, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. More of these men and women are going to get sick and they are going to die. And I am awfully tired of hearing that it's a 9/11 New York issue. Al-Qaeda didn't shout death to Tribeca. They attacked America and these men and women, and their response to it is what brought our country back. It's what gave a reeling nation a solid foundation to stand back upon, to remind us of why this country is great, of why this country is worth fighting for. And you are ignoring them. And you can end it tomorrow. Why this bill isn't unanimous consent and a standalone issue is beyond my comprehension. and I have yet to hear a reasonable explanation for why. It'll get stuck in some transportation bill or some appropriations bill and get sent over to the Senate, where a certain someone from the Senate will use it as a political football to get themselves maybe another new import tax on petroleum, because that's what happened to us in 2015. And we won't allow it to happen again. Thank God for people like John Feel. Thank God for people like Ray Pfeiffer. Thank God for all of these people who will not let it happen. They responded in 5 seconds. They did their jobs with courage, grace, tenacity, humility. 18 years later, do yours. Thank you.